C2PR. Number 5B.
Okay. Can you see that? That were my first lessons in Christian Science as a boy. My mother always taught me and said, well, not always taught me. She taught me very few things, thank God, but the real things. I was a boy and I should go and have an exam. Then one always has jitters in the knees, thinks, can I do it? And then one goes to mother, and says, mother, could you help me, you know, that I know what I have to know? And she would say to me, what about the others? So she would say, no, I'm going to know that the world, that the whole earth is full of the glory of God, as the water covers the sea. All are under the idea of mind, that the intelligence of mind. It's for the whole of mankind. I can't pray for you. I can only pray for the idea. See, she could see very clearly that all what goes on in the prayer, in this specific case, that mind is universal intelligence, and not the intelligence for me. And that stuck with me right from the beginning. That we always have to deal with an universal idea, with a universal proposition, that God does not know me as a person, as an ego. God has no people universe. If only we could find out that once and for all, not fall back anymore. That we have not to deal with a people universe, and therefore not with problems of a people universe. That we have to deal with what the Father knows, and He knows only Himself. God interprets Himself to Himself, and He doesn't know anything else but Himself. And so such an attitude of prayer, which is free from self, is really going to do something, because it's glorifying God Himself. So the whole text here, again, if you would put on your blinders and say, let's see if this tone of unselfed, that tone of spiritual understanding, both are ideas of soul, if they really flow through the whole text of prayer, you will find that it recurs and recurs and recurs. That the text is full of problems like self-immolation, self-abnegation, no self-justification, self-forgetfulness. All that comes in, that there is only one ego. So one finds prayer has nothing to do with a person. To pray for a person or for the benefit of person or for the blessing of persons. And that's some perhaps first hard to see. Because we like that we are blessed. And God cannot bless us. He can only bless His universe. Because He does not know anything about people. Yes. So, this is this. And at this point, really, Mrs. Eddy starts with the seven prayers, as you know from your preparation. And I think you have either this or something similar to this. This is on prayer. Or you have it in the great blue book. All these epitomes are bound together in the blue book. And that gives me right away an opportunity to say something about that blue book, which may not be clear for those who have not been here last year, because last year I was saying that I will put all these epitomes into one book. And I said at that time that I don't want this book to be publicly announced. So it's not in the book catalog, it will not be announced in issues of Science, because I feel I don't want to disappoint a buyer. Because if a buyer just sees, oh, here is a book by Max, oh, it's about the textbook, and the epitomes of the textbook, they think, that's wonderful, I like the textbook, and buy it. And then they get just these epitomes here, and if they are not students of us, they don't know what to do with it. And then they think, oh, they really caught me. They got my money, but I didn't get what I really wanted to get. And so we have not offered it to the public, so to say, but only to our students who can value what it is. That's one thing. And the second point we discussed last year, that I said, in this blue book is my whole life work. It's 30 years' work on the textbook, and therefore I value it very much, therefore I wouldn't like to give it or to offer it at a cheap price. I was asking you, do you remember? I was asking you what price I should put on. And then you said $100, $200, and some said $50. So I stayed with $50. It's a lot of money compared with the paper that is in it. It's very little compared with the work that is in it. And in order that I don't give the impression, you remember too, that I want to make money with it, I said the money goes, all that the proceeds from it, from the sales, go to the institute and not to my pocket, which we did. So I feel free to talk about that book for $50 because I don't get the money. But it will be used for other books and so on. So that's these are the epitomes. And as we go on with each chapter, naturally it is nice to have them all together in one book. Well, this was a side note in parentheses, and we go now to these epitomes. This is again a big subject that has balked people quite a bit when they first come to our study. But it is a method that John Dory used right from the beginning, in the middle of the 40s. Whenever he was presenting a subject from the Bible, he would always break down the book of the Bible into the subjects that represent, say, the world order, the Christ order, and would put the various subjects in so-called epitomes. Now, the point is that one has taken that as John Dorley's special way of doing things, just as everybody has their special way of doing things. The one has a beard, the other hasn't a beard. Just up to him to decide what he wants, and we don't care about it. But and therefore, one has never, or the students have not quite realized what he's doing with his epitomes. What he's doing with his epitomes is something terrific. It's a completely new method which he introduced, which the other sciences don't know but would like to have. The others, especially the humanities, not the exact science like physics and mathematics, but the humanities, would really like to know how to structure their subject. And they haven't found yet a method to do it. And John Dolittle found one through these epitomes. But naturally, he could only find it and use it and be exact because they all rely on the capitalized terms. They rely on the synonymy principle. What that means may be Greek to you right away or Chinese, I don't know, doesn't matter. But as we go on during the week, you will see what it means. Namely, in mathematics, you have exact numbers, and you calculate with very exact values, and with very exact symbols, the plus symbols, the minus symbols, and so on. But the moment you come to spiritual things, you need also values that are exact, and you need symbols for these values and for the relationship of these values. But the point is that when we come to the spiritual, the values are not limited. They are always infinite. Every value is infinite, and yet they have a value that is distinct from each other. And therefore, the synonymy principle that Mrs. Eddy used is adapted really to use definite values like mind, spirit, soul, principle, or so on. Definite values, but because they are infinite and blend with all the other values, you have to find a method that does not limit something, because the spiritual is never limited. Now, I told you this, I can see it from your face that you didn't understand me. That's all right. That's all right. But I introduced it once, and as we go on, it will become clear. But there is always an initial point where one has to jump. Huh? How do you say it? Jump in the deep? Or yes? Yeah, you have to start somewhere and then see what happens afterwards. So we are going to use this method, even if at the beginning we don't know how to use it. But little by little we know. And then afterwards, after a while, you can't do it without them. After a short time, you say, how could he do it ever without it? How can one define a subject without finitize it? Because define means to make grenzen, to make limits. But the spiritual cannot be limited. And yet you have to define your values. So to say you have to limit without limiting them. That's a big job. And the synonyms are naturally those terms of which we know that in one way they are limited and in another way they are unlimited. In one way they are limited, namely they are different from another synonymous term. Mind is very different than spirit. And then so they are limited. It's not quite the right term. You make boundaries, huh? A little bit boundaries against mind, against spirit. And you know exactly when we speak about mind and when we speak about spirit, that this is different. And yet, on the other side, they are all infinite, unlimited, because they all refer to God. So we have a subject called God. The textbook is all about that infinite God, that unlimited God. But in order to understand that unlimited God, we must somehow define its values without making limits. Well, so forget it at the moment. I introduced it, and then we'll see the value when we practically do it, and also it's much easier. But there is another subject I have to take up with the epitomes, namely that great question, how do we arrive at these epitomes? You have a whole book, and I say, here you have a whole book of epitomes, that blue book. It's a life work in it. It's not just writing down some nice ideas that came to me. It's polished and polished and polished and polished, huh? Over 30 years. And therefore has a certain value, certain definite value. But you can say, how did you arrive at that? And so I must tell you a little bit about how we proceed, about the procedure in text interpretation. We have, let's take a text like the chapter on prayer, just to limit the extent of the subject. You have those 17, 18 pages. How do we approach ordinarily such a chapter? We read it. We read it. We read it sentence by sentence. We try to understand each sentence. We are happy if we understand it and go to the next sentence. And after 2 pages, you don't know anymore what you have read. Don't you agree with that? That's what balked me as a student, right way back at the university time. How on earth somebody like Mrs. Eddy could say, I have discovered a science, and I present you a science, and then when you read it, you don't know what you have read. That was a bit too much. I had to read many textbooks on many subjects, and always knew what was reading. And if one didn't know what one was reading for the first time, one certainly knew it the second time. But here is a textbook you can read your head off. You don't know what is in it. You can remember here a sentence, there a sentence. But you don't know what you have read. Why? Why? So, John Dorley found the method. But naturally that method relies on what we have said, that we first have to know the tonality of the system of reference. The 7, the 4, the 4. Without that tonality, we cannot decode the text of a chapter. Because the words that are there, they don't give the meaning. Meaning is relational. The meaning of a word is not in the word. The meaning of the word is in its context. So, in order to understand the context, you have to ask not what the words mean, but what the subject means about which Mrs. Eddy writes. The subject. But that is not spelled out. That is a tone. That is an absolute tone. So, if we have the tonality of the 3 categories, we have at least the tones of the spiritual language, language of spirit, and therefore can read the text by not reading the words, but the tones. Does that make somehow sense? Only a little bit, I don't ask more than that. That you read words, but that you don't read the words. But that you read the whole subject behind it. We'll do that. We'll do that right away today. So, the method one uses is this. One has a text like prayer, and doesn't know what is in it. Then one begins to read that text fluently with that consciousness of the tonality And while reading the words, one tries to hear the tones of the three categories. Can you hear the difference? You don't read all those terms that they may be before they. These are terms, there are words. We don't read them. We read the subject. We read the tonality of the capitalized terms. And if one does that, and the better one's consciousness is cultured in those in that tonality, the easier one can see that Mrs. Eddy takes up a subject, not the text, a subject through the text, and talks about that subject, and talks about that subject, and suddenly stops and starts to talk about another subject, still using the same terms, if and when and end and before and after and so on. But the subject changes. And you read further and further and you say, oh yes, she's still talking about this subject, still talking about the same subject. And you come to a new paragraph and you certainly say, oh golly, she's no more talking about the same subject. What is it that changes here? And you have a change, you have a break. And you read on, and after a while you say, oh, she talks now about the third subject, about this and this and this. And it goes on and on for a few pages. You come again to a break where you say, oh, she stops talking about the subject. She takes up something very different. So this is the method how I was decoding the whole textbook. Do you know I decoded that whole textbook as you have it more or less here in that book within 3 months? Within 3 months. Once the tonality was so cultured, actually I cultured it through the Bible, so cultured, you actually could hear the subjects, and you didn't read anymore with the eyes the words. Your spiritual ear heard God speaking in the language of spirit, in the language either of mind, or in the language of spirit, or in the language of soul, or of principle, life, truth, and love, or in the language of the Word, or of the Word as the Word, or of the Word as Christ. You hear that because a sounding board within ourselves, so to say, is so transparent that it can catch those tones easily. Just as you can catch music if you are trained in music and know exactly when an instrument plays wrongly. You hear it at once because something in you is so cultured in music that it detects not only the rightness of the music, but also when something goes wrong. And in this way, one would read a chapter and just mark where the subject changes. And perhaps in the first reading you are not quite sure, or you have perhaps not always found where the subject changes definitely, if it's the paragraph before or paragraph afterwards or so. But more or less you can see it, and then you begin to say to yourself, now, what are these subjects? Say, in prayer, you feel very definitely that there are 7 prayers up to the Lord's Prayer, that there are 7 very different subjects of prayer. And so you mark your break in the textbook, and now then you say, now I have, say, 7 subjects, and you say to yourself, what are they now? Can I define them to me, what I have felt? Can I define to me the atmosphere, the spiritual atmosphere which I have felt? And so then the work begins, where one begins to try to formulate an epitome. An epitome is core of a longer text. You have a text of the prayer of mind that goes over 2 pages, and you say to yourself, what is now the core of it? If I take the garnish away and come to the real thing, what is that real thing? Can I reduce those 2 pages into 1 sentence, and if possible into a short sentence, into such a short sentence that you really have the main point in it, and not the sideline, not the, as I say, the garnish. Huh? It's like a nice beefsteak plate with all the garnish around it. You get to the beefsteak and not to the parsley and so on that lies around. You go to the core of it, and you formulate your epitome. Then, when one was able to formulate as clearly as possible, you say, now, what category does this represent? And so you have the prayer of desire, the first prayer of desire to know God as He is, and you say, what does that mean? If I still shorten that more, if you have the desire to know God the way He is, you say, God, that's mind. That's the knowledge of mind, the knowing of mind. And so you can reduce still further that epitome to a synonymous term. That which you usually have on the left-hand side of the epitomes, you have mind, spirit, soul, principle. So that is the shortest expression, so to say a shorthand representation of a long text, that reduce and reduce until you come to the pure language of spirit. The pure language of spirit speaks only in the capitalized terms. It doesn't need all the grammar for it, because it's the language of spirit. And that doesn't need English grammar nor German grammar. It's atmosphere, spirit atmosphere. And in this way, you arrive at what? You arrive that you say, oh, this is, the first one is mine. Oh, the second one, that's spirit. Oh, the third one, that's soul. And therefore you suddenly see something further, namely that it is the word order. See, the moment something is built up in mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth, and love, you have the word order. And suddenly prayer becomes an ordered prayer. Can you see what we gain? You see, the pith of a science is always to take a big field of facts and reduce them and reduce them and reduce them to simplicity. Then you can, when you have done that, you can formulate that either into laws or orders or a system. That's science. To take the whole field of physics and bring it back to a few laws. Well, that's what we have to do with the textbook. We have here the infinite, but we cannot understand the infinite as an infinite. We can only understand the infinite through its own nature, through its own science. And therefore we have to reduce that infinite to those categories which are still infinite, but are reduced to those constituents of the infinite that can be grasped easily. So finally, you have the whole chapter on prayer. Reduced, it means, in the language of the capitalized term, says, well, prayer actually is nothing else but the word as the word in the word order. If I say that, it doesn't move you. Not at all. It moves me. See, it moves me. Because I know what the word as word is. And I know what the word order is. For me, it's a spiritual language. That means much more than all these terms that are in the text. There's so much weight in it that does not relate to the language of spirit.